listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we have a conversation with Danny Haifong, the journalist and activist who now resides in the New York City area. We spoke with him via Skype from New York on Thursday. Dan, a pleasure. It's been way too long. And we're going to go through this whole phenomenology of quote-unquote resistance. I don't know, you should maybe register trademark after resistance. with these various, you know, I don't know. They used to be called AstroTurf. This is maybe more of a hybrid grass, but that has all these the mass media involved in organizing and Democratic Party involved in organizing. A lot of people that normally are grassroots organizers also involved in organizing. And then, of course, wall-to-wall media sympathetic coverage.
Right, and this was most recently seen in the March for Our Lives that happened a few weeks ago in March, where hundreds of thousands of people across the country came out to protest quote-unquote gun violence and got behind the idea of gun control, which is not a new issue at all. It's something really that has been talked about almost ad nauseum every time a quote-unquote mass shooting happens inside of the United States involving a white perpetrator, usually from the suburbs, ends up shooting up a school, that sort of thing. It's been happening a lot more in recent years, despite the fact that gun violence as a whole has actually gone down in the United States. But what makes this march in particular even more significant is the fact that it comes in the era of Trump, where the ascendancy of the Trump administration has also precipitated a rebellion of billionaires, where the billionaire, or at least the servicemen of billionaires that a significant section of the ruling class wanted and Hillary Clinton did not, take office, and Donald Trump ended up filling a vacuum that the ruling class could not fill. So here we are, where billionaires like Michael Bloomberg, Eli Broad, Warren Buffett have coalesced around this issue of gun control in order to try to take back the congressional seats in the midterm elections coming up, all on behalf of the Democrats. What's ended up happening, though, is that this issue has become a mass issue, one that people have taken very strong stances for and against, and it's really distracted from the real question of gun violence, the fact that the U.S. government sells the most weapons around the world to violent dictatorial regimes of Israel, Qatar, Saudi Arabia.
And itself, by the way.
In itself, it buys weapons from Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed Martin in order to rain terror over the people of Syria and people all over the world, right. The Middle East, Africa, you name it, all seven continents. So, you know, we have this issue of gun control and gun violence being completely narrowed down in order to serve one section of the billionaire ruling class, while things like the rampant lynchings of black people at the hands of the police continue unabated. Yesterday, a black person in Crown Heights here in New York City was murdered by the police, and that was preceded by the murder of Stephon Clark in Sacramento earlier in March. So yeah, this whole question of gun violence and the March for Our Lives never mentions these facts, because if you look at the advisory board of every town USA, you see people like Warren Buffett, you see people like Michael Bloomberg, but also you see an assortment of former Navy personnel, former police chief personnel. So really what's happened is that a certain section of the billionaires has coalesced around this issue in order to try to take back Democratic Party control over the House and the Senate. So
even establishment control. I mean, you know, it's interesting to note that, and this is something that's not really part of the discussion yet, but at least that I've been paying attention to. But you've got what were the wedge issues in the 80s and 90s? You had abortion and gun control became the focal points of difference and distinction between the Democrats and Republicans. And consequently, there was a unanimity of policy on everything else, on war and peace. You know, both parties would support whatever war was happening, on you know, questions of you know, withdrawing public services, privatization, you know, all of these things that we've suffered continuously now for the last 30 some odd years. There was instead placed dead center abortion and gun control as the wedge issues, and then we saw in the phenomenon, you know, it started stirring with the crash in 2008, but then the 2016 election in particular, the phenomenon that lifted both Trump and Sanders, that was sort of a rejection of all of that and a focus on economic issues at front and center, and issues of war and peace, by the way, with respect to Trump, which was an unusual thing. But in other words, suddenly there were people voting in the Republican Party primaries, for example, well, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio were pointing at Trump and saying he's not sufficiently anti-abortion. The Republican core that had been voting on that issue for a couple of decades was saying, the hell with abortion, that guy said he's going to get me a job. And that happened, you know, a lot across the electoral landscape. And also, there was this rejection generally of the institutional framework for electoral politics that had preceded, which again centered on, to distill it, abortion and gun control. And now, as they attempt to manage this uprising that we saw, that this is the thing that they're bringing to, you know, front and center now is gun control, and I bet you see abortion end up there again too.
Right. What ends up happening in these questions is that a class analysis is completely erased and left out of the conversation. I think what the 2016 elections really showed us is that the material questions affecting working class people, affecting poor people, affecting Black people, affecting undocumented immigrants really came to the fore in a way that hasn't been able to happen or wasn't able to happen, especially under the era of Obama. And I think the coalescing of the ruling class around these particular issues is really an attempt to try to suppress the genuine material demands that people have that were building up prior to the 2016 elections with the advent of the Occupy Wall Street movement, right. The Black Lives Matter movement.
Yep.
These developments really show that at least on the domestic front, there was a stirring among the people, especially younger people who really ended up, especially younger Black voters, who really ended up taking it to the Democratic Party by staying out of the election. No one talks about that.
That's right.
So what we've seen is this desperation among the ruling class to try to reconfigure itself and realign the imperialist system in the way that it wants. So that's why we have gun control and gun violence on the one hand, giving some respite to the rancorous and completely loud and cacophonous calls for war with Russia, which is right now the real unifying point that everyone on the ruling class, except ironically, maybe a few people in the Trump camp, have been pushing since Trump won. And this is because partly war with Russia is a big policy point and a big plan among the ruling class, and it has been for years. It's on the agenda, but also the material questions that people in the United States and most people around the world who are living, you know, on less than $10 a day, billions of them, really want are off the table. Bruce Dixon had a really good article in Black Agenda Report last week talking about why gun violence has been so narrowed, and that's because things like single-payer healthcare, peace around the world, demilitarization of the police, demilitarization of the military, all of these things are off of the table because the imperial system is going in one direction, the ruling class is going in one direction, and more people are becoming aware of this.
Yeah. It's you know, they're trying to put the genie back in the bottle to a degree, and you saw the potential for this kind of uprising being barely latent. The WTO protests, you know, in the late 90s, but particularly like the almost immediate mobilization against the war in Iraq in February and March of 2003. You know, millions and millions of people around the world, like, bam, like that. And then the same thing that happened with Occupy Wall Street. It was like when someone lit a match, you know, across the world.
Exactly.
And so a lot of that got tamped down during the Obama administration for a variety of reasons. The material world has a tendency of bringing reality back to people, regardless of whatever consciousness they try to, you know, fit onto their head. And the situation has become, over a period of decades, more and more desperate for more and more people. And I think that we kind of passed a turning point sometime in 2014, early 2015, where it started to show up in the electoral process, you know, and we saw it in the streets. First of all, one final shooting was just too much, and, you know, people exploded in cities across the United States with Black Lives Matter and all other manifestations of that phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to see both that came into the electoral process, and Hillary Clinton tried to manage it and failed. And then you also had this other phenomenon again, you know, Trump and Sanders, that everybody's shaking their head saying, what? Mm-hmm. Sanders wasn't supposed to have a chance, and Trump was supposed to be, you know, more of a vanity run than anything, and now he's president.
Exactly. And the ruling class had to, that coalesced around Hillary Clinton, had to steal it from Sanders. They had to steal the victory from him.
They did.
Which is what makes it so, which makes it so disappointing when leftists, people who identify on the left in the United States, become so defensive about criticisms regarding things like March for Our Lives. I mean, you see the corporate media elevate so-called surviving youth of the shooting that happened in Parkland. Right. And of course, young people shouldn't be denigrated. However, if we look at this from a class analysis perspective, if we understand that young people their age are unlikely to have the resources to develop a movement of such a caliber, to mobilize forces, to have the resources available that can produce something like the hundreds of thousands of people that came out during the March for Our Lives event, then we know that there's obviously something else behind it. You know, us Marxian thinkers and activists understand that being determines consciousness.
Right.
And if we understand that the current conditions where a nonprofit like Everytown Against Gun Violence is funded by billionaires and other spooks, as well as the national security apparatus, then we know that they have a heavy hand in determining where exactly the ideology of that mobilization is going to go. And it's most likely going to go into efforts to stabilize and maintain the system of imperialism. And so if we're criticizing the fact that these relatively wealthy youth are not mentioning things like Black Lives Matter or endless war abroad, the police violence against Black people here in the United States, we do that because that's really the source of gun violence, and that's really and those are really issues that determine the struggle on a class basis that that affect poor Black people here in the United States, working class Black people, and that affect workers all around the world. And that's where we need to be focusing our attention, because at the end of the day, whatever hapless, and it really never happens, it's probably not going to, whatever hapless legislation is produced out of these so-called spontaneous uprisings managed and controlled by the billionaire ruling class happens to produce, where are we then?
Yeah,
where
are we then
with more background
best,
checks, with stigmatizing mentally ill people? Where are we? We're at square one. We have no analysis of the society that we live in, and we have, or the system that we live under, and we are, you know, we are still under the whims of whatever the bourgeoisie, the ruling class, and its military state apparatus wants.
Right. Yeah, I mean, whatever comes out is at best mischievous, you know. There comes some kind of a, you know, of legislation that does nothing but, you know, make people fill out some more forms, or, you know, make it difficult for this person or that person to, you know, go to the beauty parlor on Tuesday or something that has nothing to do
with. Or maybe even put more police in communities around the country, which we know what will happen.
Right.
When that occurs,
there's all, because look at the drug, you know, the war on drugs, for example,
like exactly,
phenomenon. So you also have, I mean, if you want to ban assault rifles, for example, why not just ban them? I mean, for everybody. So you cannot manufacture them, and you reach a global treaty banning assault rifles, banning machine guns, banning, you know, all of these things that are capable of, you know, causing mass casualties, banning, by the way, nuclear weapons, napalm, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That is something that is consistent because, you know, by the way, not for nothing, if some kids or whatever, some deranged individuals are so focused on causing mass casualties that are now using assault rifles and now they're not accessible anymore, does that mean that they're not going to try to cause mass casualties, or are they going to go find something else? Like, if nothing else, let me make my own homemade nuclear weapon and bring it to high school. you know, or a chemical weapon, or you know, TNT or whatever.
Right.
I mean, exactly. You're in a world full of weaponry. Stop making weapons.
Yeah. Well, we could do that under another social arrangement, but under this one, that opens up a whole can of worms that the national security state, military state apparatus in the United States cannot have, which is what makes this issue very interesting on the one hand, as much as it can be disappointing on the ideological and political front in the here and now. We know that this issue of quote-unquote gun violence is really a pressure cooker, because the more that you talk about things like assault rifles, the more and more you start treading towards the real root of all violence in the United States and around the world, led by the United States, which is the military state, the massive production of weapons for the profit.
As Martin Luther King put it, my own government.
Yep. Is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And that has not changed. And that's the reason why these things happen. And if we look at the bios of some of these shooters, oftentimes they come from families of
military
state, intelligence apparatuses, or they've been investigated by the intelligence apparatus for years and nothing happens. So we know that it's the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. These massive shootings are really a product of an increasingly alienated and militarized society.
That's correct. Yep.
And they won't stop, because really the ruling class has no interest in stopping these things from happening, because
it's just more chaos on the ground. I mean, you know.
Exactly. And that's what also makes this so-called movement against gun violence so problematic, is that the very forces behind it, the billionaires, the military state, the police state, all of these forces are behind all of this violence. Meanwhile, you know, not to say the 50 or however many people die from mass shootings through the United States is really a drop in the bucket compared to what happens around the world at the hands of the United States military or the police here in the United States. But none of it is going to stop if the very forces behind it are the ones driving the movement.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that, if you were a news producer at, say, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, whatever, you have the archive of, military attacks by the United States, just say on Iraq alone, let alone Iraq, Libya, all these places all over the world. How much footage do you have of smoldering schools? You know, they got blown up. Mm-hmm. Like in Gaza. I mean, the Israelis blow up schools regularly because they say Hamas is hiding in the basement or whatever. So I'm a news producer, and I want to explore the issue of violence. There's 168 hours a week of programming on my channel. There's news, there's Fox, there's this, there's like seven or eight, major producers of television news. So times 168 per week hours. Maybe I'm going to run like a 7-minute piece where I've got somebody talking about, violence in the schools in the United States. So I start with a video of them on the podium, and then I start showing the video of schools that were obliterated by the U.S., the Israelis, the Saudis, etc., with U.S. weaponry. That hasn't happened at all. This thing has been going on now for, 2 months, 3 months, whatever. So let's say for 10 weeks, that's 1,680 hours. There hasn't been a minute like that on any of those 7 or 8 channels. That's not an accident.
It is not.
Not just what's missing, but what's on is consciously chosen.
Exactly.
Purposeful.
It's consciously chosen. And what's usually on is Russia, Russia, Russia. Putin, Trump is an agent of Russia.
Right.
Putin is stealing the elections. Putin is poisoning former FSB agents in the UK. There's always another story about why the Russian government, why Vladimir Putin needs to be taken out. But there's no stories at all, unless Trump murmurs something that's completely unfathomable, like pulling out of Syria. Unless something like that happens, or Trump starts getting bellicose with the DPRK, unless something like that happens where Trump is on the right side or on the wrong side, there really is no conversation about war. When there is, it's not a conversation we want to be having.
He's got them all baffled right now with his China, with his China stuff. He's got them baffled because, and with the backstory being Korea, you know, we may actually see a peace treaty in Korea that's 65 years overdue.
Exactly.
But as you know, they want war with Russia and China. You know, they, mm-hmm. I mean, let me be more accurate. They want to control and loot Russia and China, and exactly. Because Russia and China refuse, that means that they're looking towards war with Russia and China. Because that exactly. Just because Russia and China says no, it doesn't mean they're going away. They're going after that stuff. So, well, and now suddenly Trump starts, you know, this stuff with tariffs with China, and China spits back, and the stock market dips, and they do this and that. And like on the one hand, they want to stab Trump because this is their impulse. I thought he said he made the stock market go up, and now he's making it go down, and it's going to cost consumers this and that. On the other hand, it's like, hey, but he's kicking Xi in the you know where. That's a good thing. They don't know how to handle it. I'm watching it and sort of laughing.
Exactly. It's all indicative of the fact that the U.S. and its imperial system has completely lost control, not only of the narrative, but also of the ability to dominate at its whim without any questions asked. We have a situation where China and Russia are not going anywhere, and short of a nuclear war of annihilation, there really is no stopping the march of China on the economic front. There's no stopping Russia's growth economically and militarily. We know that now that Russia has weapons capable of truly defending itself from such a war, that there is a real panic on the part of the U.S. ruling class, especially on the military side, that this march toward a multipolar world, this new world arrangement where U.S. hegemony is not the determining factor of development economically, politically, culturally, and militarily, that's all very concerning. And Trump in office only makes it harder because He really has no stake in any of this as an individual, right. And that's always been the case. And that's always what has concerned them, is that Trump is for him, he's for his career, he's for what makes him look best at any given moment. And we know that in the realm of politics, that changes from minute to minute.
For sure.
And so that's why we have this inconsistency. We have Trump sometimes being bellicose towards Russia and the DPRK, and then pulling out things that you would never think would happen, such as a conversation with the DPRK, because on the one hand, Trump is a bellicose, kind of rabidly bigoted billionaire. But on the other hand, we have a world situation that he is not in control of. The DPRK and Korea as a whole have made huge steps towards peace. China has been a big part of that. Russia has made huge steps towards becoming an independent power in the world again. And those things Trump has no say in, other than how he responds at any given moment.
Well, right, exactly. I mean, then the question is basically, I mean, the conditions exist now where, because it's Trump that's sitting in the Oval Office, he actually has the political ability to allow what's happening with Korea to unfold that way without having to. In other words, if the two presidents of Korea and, say, Xi and Abe have a meeting and a public declaration of unification, like they have a 1989 Berlin moment, Trump can actually say, this is good, and we will pull our troops back, or whatever arrangement they make, actually allow it to happen. A lot of others, this is like a Nixon goes to China moment in terms of that. He's got the quote-unquote credentials to allow this to happen. That's kind of part of the story that's going on there too. He did a lot of chest thumping. He was calling the North Korean leader Rocket Man and the little guy. I was waiting for the little hands thing again and all this stuff.
We'll obliterate
you. Okay, he was saying stuff that people were saying, say what? And so he's got the creds to turn around and say, this is good for the United States. I've looked this through, letting Korea develop, blah, blah, blah. You no longer have a maniac communist group in the North, but now it's all capitalist, and they're out to make money, and we're going to make money with them.
Yeah, and we know that every president of the United States, in order to stay relevant to the ruling class, needs a foreign policy trademark. They need need something to make a legacy.
Right.
And that's, you know, there's people all over Trump's ear saying,
right,
this is what presidents do. They have foreign policy. They have foreign policy moves that really reflect their legacy. Obama had his with the so-called Iran deal. And, you know, that was just after Hillary Clinton said that, you know, they wanted to obliterate Iran. So these things kind of go in cycles. And it's interesting that when it happens to Trump, there is all of this cacophony and raucous, not for the cause of peace, but to ensure that regardless of what Trump does, that the war machine continues on. And I think that is a general trend in the United States politically, is that until resistance really takes an independent character, is really rooted in the rebellion and the uprisings happening politically in working class, poor communities, we will continue to see the ruling class attempt to resist Trump on the basis of ensuring that he maintains a stance on things like war, economic policy, all of that is palatable to them. And things like gun violence, the March for Our Lives, will merely reflect that in the final analysis. And we have to be ready to challenge that.
And parse it,
too. Exactly, and parse it. Because these are issues, they say, are life and death. You know, in the March for Lives, that's what they kept on saying.
Right.
But in reality, class war is not only life and death of a few hundred people here and there. It's life and death for an entire class of people, one that is built now billions in numbers, which is the working class, the proletariat.
Right. That's right, absolutely. And we're going to stop there. Dan, thank you very much.
All right, take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. After weeks of media hysterics and official claims without a shred of evidence, the case that Russia was behind the Salisbury poisoning incident is falling apart. Transparency and the rule of law have never played a role. It has always been about politics and a pernicious agenda. What happens next, sadly, is only too predictable. Crosstalking toxic politics, I'm joined by my guest, Markus Papadopoulos, in London. He's the editor of Politics First magazine. Also in London, we have Alexander Nekrasov. He is a political commentator and a former Kremlin advisor. And in Plymouth, we cross to Patrick Henningsen. He is a journalist, writer, and founder of the news website, 21stCenturyWire.com. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Alexander, let me go to you first in London. You know, so much is happening. I'd like to point out that Yulia is actually spoken to the media. Apparently, she had a phone call with her sister in Russia, and she's not giving up very much. But I have to say, what a miraculous recovery from, if we start from the beginning of the story, you know, and toxic agent 10 times worse than VX and on, seeing how the media has changed its story. The government has been stonewalling. There's been no transparency whatsoever. There is no cooperation cooperation with Russia that is asked to be part of the investigation. I mean, just stonewalling here. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, Peter, first of all, what I find completely bizarre is that practically from day one, all of the British media, all of it, I stress, have been covering this story in exactly the same way, sometimes in exactly the same words and phrases. Now, I'm sorry, but how does that, you know, free media work here? Who is giving the instructions? Who is giving the orders? Because I find it very difficult to imagine how, let's say, you know, 100, 200, 300 journalists report in exactly the same way and basically guess most of the things that are happening and provide no proof at all. I thought that was very strange. Secondly, what I found absolutely bizarre is that we were told right from the start that this was a supposedly a nerve agent, military-grade nerve agent, which for some reason was called Novichok, which was, by the way, Novichok was never developed in the Soviet Union. It was something that was invented in America. But if that was a military-grade nerve agent,
right,
by now, both the Skripals and the policemen who supposedly saved their lives would be long dead. There is no way they would have survived.
But
so that point somehow missed all the attention of the media.
Well, it seems like a miraculous recovery here. Let me go to Marcus. It seems to me that Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, he's suffering from portent down syndrome, okay? Because what is his story? We have tweets being deleted at the foreign ministry here. He was categorically informed that this was a nerve agent that came from Russia. And, of course, we find out that is not true. Why does he still have his job, Marcus?
Well, Boris Johnson is completely and utterly inept. And whilst there are calls for him to resign over his statements on what happened in Salisbury, of course, he is not going to resign, because if he resigned, that would be an admission of guilt on his behalf. And of course, the British government's case against Russia over Salisbury would be all the more weakened. But also, Theresa May is not going to sack him, because if she did sack him, then that would initiate a very, very vicious response from the right wing of the Conservative Party, because the right wing of the Conservative Party is very supportive of Boris Johnson. So, regrettably, Boris Johnson is not going anywhere. But that said, even if he was to resign, even if he was to be sacked, his successor would keep to the same narrative.
Right.
And if I can very quickly just set the scene, anyone who's familiar with the history of Anglo-Russian relations was not surprised by how, within a few hours of the tragic events in Salisbury, the British government and British mainstream media were blaming the Russian state. Because ever since diplomatic relations were established between London and Moscow in 1595, Russia has been viewed in Whitehall and Westminster as almost the devil incarnate. Over 500 years or so, the ground has been set in Britain to make any accusation against Russia by a British politician or a British mainstream journalist, and they don't need evidence to back it up.
Yep. You know, Patrick, you know, Marcus used the term the case against Russia. What is the case here? All I can see is on the international stage is a lot of elbowing, a lot of pressure being put on. When we had with the OPCW decision, if you look at the membership, it has a global membership, but it was the people that wanted to make sure that Russia wasn't part of the process, either are in NATO or in the European Union. Latin America and Asia, they didn't go along with it at all. It's intensely politicized. And so what is the case? Because I haven't been given any evidence yet, okay? But it seems like it's already gone to trial, and the same people that brought it to trial are the jury. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, it's a curious case. Imagine the prosecutor makes the accusations against the defendant, but won't allow the defendant to see the evidence and is presumed guilty straight out of the gate. It's absolutely incredible. But, you know, let's look at this. Where did this term Novichok come from? And this is really interesting, and this is something that's kind of casually glossed over by the media. There's very little evidence of any program or anything called Novichoks, even in back to the Soviet Union chemical weapons research and development days. So what it is a GV class, which is a 230 to 260 of agents. And the reason this term Novichok has been thrown out, I think people need to look at this, it is to deflect from the fact that, which your first guest pointed out, Alexander, the United States is the only one to develop this at Edgewood Proving Grounds, the United States Army's Biological and Chemical Weapons Proving Grounds in Edgewood, Maryland, in 1998. This was published in NIST, okay? So the United States, for this class, which is not a Novichok, Novichok was a term invented by a Russian defector who published it in his book in 2008. So this is a really important point because it deflects from the fact that the United States itself is the one nation on record who has developed and worked on this class of nerve agents that is publicly known.
You know, Alexander, to date there has been no transparency, just accusations. Unfortunately, I have to believe that we're not going to ever get any evidence whatsoever. It'll always be shrouded, and it will because this is really not about the attack or apparent attack on two people, one a former double agent and his daughter, but this is about pushing forward an agenda, a very nefarious one at that, because I don't see this is just one step in a process, okay? And so this is why I don't think we'll ever get any kind of transparency on this case. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, as you know, Peter, 15 years ago, another prime minister stood up in the Commons and made up allegations about chemical weapons against Iraq, and also quoted intelligence agencies and said he can't reveal the details. And then the war happened and a million people or more died and so on. And we still don't know anything, how it worked. So I think we are in a similar situation now with another prime minister. I think, to be honest with you, Peter, I think there is no nerve agent.
I agree.
There was no nerve agent over there.
Until you give
me
any evidence.
They're making up.
Give me evidence. I agree.
Up.
Go ahead.
And you know why I say this? Because when I watched that Portendown chief executive giving his take on this so-called Novichok, and I felt that the reason why he said we can't trace it is because there is none. I mean, what do you mean? Did he mean we can't understand where it came from? If they are the top professionals, of course they could have told that. There is nothing for them to examine. And when I saw those, you know, Portendown boys dressed up in those fancy defensive gear, walking around, and around them passers-by and cops were looking at them, you know, with interest. I thought, this is a fancy dress party. They're just making it look as if there is something there.
It's certainly good for the cameras, isn't it? Okay, Marcus, let me go to you. Jeremy Corbyn is being pillared for this as well, and I find that's because there's so many elements. As we have NATO, we have the European Union, we have Brexit, and we have the Labour opposition, and they're turning this full blast against him in a very shameful. I'm a conservative. He's way to the left of me, but what the media is doing to him is shameful. Go ahead, Marcus.
Well, ever since Jeremy Corbyn became an MP in 1983, he has consistently called out British foreign policy. He's consistently called out American foreign policy. He has consistently challenged British mainstream media. And history shows that he has been correct. He was correct about what happened in the former Yugoslavia. He was correct about what happened in Iraq. He was correct about Libya. He was correct about Ukraine. And he was correct about Syria. But what I believe is all the more frightening about how British mainstream media is treating him is the level of abuse.
Yep.
Because yes, they have tackled him over the last, you know, 30 odd years, but the personal abuse against him is absolutely horrific, being called a traitor, being called a Putin apologist. This is not something which should be tolerated in Britain, because after all, Britain is supposed to be a democracy, there is supposed to be rule of law, there is supposed to be respect in British politics. But when it comes to Jeremy Corbyn, none of that is there. And we have to ask, why is that the case?
Right.
It's very, very simple, Peter, because Jeremy Corbyn terrifies the British establishment. He terrifies the British government.
He's a genuine threat.
He terrifies British mainstream media. They don't want him to be prime minister. He's a genuine threat to them. And also, he's a genuine politician. He's a genuine human being. And regrettably, there's not many people like him in politics in the world.
I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen, and we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on toxic politics. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Let's go back to Plymouth. Patrick, kind of give us the lay of the land when it comes to international politics. I'm thinking about the EU, Brexit, and NATO here, because I think these are very important pieces that they're trying to bring into this story here, basically trying to keep some semblance of unity when it is flagging. Everyone knows that. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, well, The dogs were unleashed yesterday in the British press on Theresa May and Boris Johnson. So they, in a way, they've kind of sprung their own trap in this sense. So it's possible that if the establishment wanted to bury the embarrassment of the Novichok hoax or the Novichok story, that May and Boris could very well be eventually buried with that or attached to that. But then on the other hand, the breaking ranks in Germany, Angela Merkel's, one of her close deputies, has come out and basically criticized Britain for invoking this kind of solidarity of faith between the EU or NATO member states to sort of accept some sort of presumption of guilt on the basis of no evidence at all. So Willy Wimmer, the former vice president of the OECD, he put this very well. He said this threatens to undermine these very multilateral institutions. In other words, if you cry wolf this time, you might not be able to actually do it again. They're already on thin ice, as you mentioned earlier, with regards to Libya and so forth. So this is really risky. In terms of evoking this kind of stand with your allies mantra, this is kind of the overriding theme so far we've seen, with the United States doing as well, coming in right behind Britain on this, as well as its NATO partners. So that's how it looks geopolitically.
You know, Alexander, I found it really quite extraordinary looking at the U.S. State Department spokeswoman just taking Theresa May's word. I mean, you don't do that in international politics. You don't do it when the stakes are so high like this. It is just the lack of professionalism, and it adds to the perception that this is some kind of agenda that's being played out here. And it also, and if we could go back to the UK here, I mean, with Brexit in chaos here, it looks like the May government is trying to find unity, you know, accusing Russia, changing the narrative here and trying to rebuild her strength in the polls, which are flagging. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, what I find completely puzzling is that this anti-Russian stance by the May government is not popular amongst the British public. I can see that by the comments on social media.
Yep.
I meet a lot of people who recognize me on the streets because they see me on television, and they tell me they don't believe May and her government. And this is what I find completely puzzling as regards this sort of public relations exercise. But my opinion, Peter, is that I think they are trying to bury Brexit. I think that what they are doing is they are trying to create this so-called threat to Britain coming from Russia. They say the war has been brought to our territory by Russia. An act of war has been taking place. I think what they're going to do, they're going to basically cancel Brexit and say, in the light of such dangerous situation, we'd better stick with our allies and we better, well, if not cancel Brexit, but extend the transition period, which is a devastating transition period, because it was negotiated in a way that I find it's completely incompetent from the position of the British government. And don't forget, Peter, there are many, many other serious problems and scandals in the background, including the paedophile scandals, the corruption scandals with huge corporations on government contracts suddenly going bankrupt, and many, many others. So I think it suits Theresa May's government to have some sort of a huge, huge distraction. And this is used as a distraction. And what they're missing, the ministers in her government, is that they are not getting popular with the British public. That's the most amazing thing.
Marcus, what is amazing also is that blaming Russia, I don't care where you are in the Western world. Oh, Russia meddled in the election in the U.S. and gave us Trump here. Russia meddled in Brexit. That's why it happened here. We go down the list of so many different things. It is the most convenient distraction you can come up with because the media is completely in on it. The elites really like it because the people in the Western world demand change and they're not being given it. They're being told national security trumps their democratic rights and expressions. Go ahead, Marcus in London.
Well, Peter, whilst I'm not downplaying the significance of what's happened in Salisbury, because it is very serious, however, it is part and parcel of, historically speaking, a very troublesome, a very problematic relationship between Britain and Russia. As I said at the beginning of this program, for 500 years, Britain and Russia have viewed each other with mutual suspicion, mutual hostility, mutual bitterness. This is part, Salisbury is part and parcel of this relationship. But if I can very quickly just take us back to Salisbury, you know, the conclusion of British scientists that they cannot determine the source of the alleged nerve agent is absolutely devastating to the British case
yep.
against Russia.
Yep.
But that said, within 24 hours, the same scientists said that they have now discovered the source. Well, what a remarkable turnaround of events. You know, I'm really sure that no pressure was put on them. You know, in the words of Tommy Cooper, it happened just like that.
Just like that. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Patrick, what is the purpose of all of this? I mean, do they expect Russia to say admit guilt, to say sorry? I mean, and then we have Theresa May saying there will be a proportional response. What does that mean? Are they going to poison someone in Moscow? I mean, what it is, it's so much bluster here. I don't see it as a very focused thing. I mean, what is the outcome that they want? Because if the Russians are not allowed to be part of the process in international organizations, not just bilaterally, but in international organizations, you know, what is the point of having these organizations and investigations if all of the players under international law cannot participate? Go ahead.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on here, obviously, on many different levels. But I think I'll pick up on your last point. You just looked at the emergency meeting with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and a roll call vote was taken. And it was 17, I believe, abstentions.
Right.
So in total, 23 countries either voted against the UK and the US position and sided with Russia. So it's not the world, it's NATO versus
exactly.
Russia. And I think there's a lot of pressure put to bear on some of those countries behind the scenes. You have UN Ambassador Nikki Haley threatening to be taking names if the vote doesn't go their way. We've seen a record of this, undermining multilateral institutions, undermining international relations. And the last thing I'll say is that the propaganda has been so thick in the United States and Britain that we have a situation now, Alexander, your guest pointed out very correctly, that the majority of the British public probably don't buy this official conspiracy theory. But we have a situation where the ruling class are actually a victim of their own propaganda over decades, that many of them in Westminster actually believe this. I'll probably ask Marcus, you know, what does he think? How many MPs actually believe in the conspiracy theory or are being held in a whip line? That would be my question. I'd throw to Marcus.
It's a great question. Marcus, what do you think?
I would say that privately, there are a significant percentage of MPs, whilst not necessarily saying that Russia didn't do it, but at the same time, they are questioning the British government's argument. And these same MPs from a number of parties are fearful of taking a stand. Now, that is regrettable. We elect MPs to take a stand, but they are fearful because of the backlash that they will receive from British mainstream media. The language which is being used by British newspapers to describe anyone who's questioning the British case against Moscow is absolutely disgusting.
Yep.
You know, we're hearing talk about traitors. We're hearing talk about useful idiots. So, yes, there is truth. There are a number of MPs who privately think very differently, but regrettably, they're not going to say that publicly.
Part of the genetic code of professional politicians is cowardice. Alexander, let me go to you. A lot of people have said since this whole thing started, this is a gambit to derail Russia's World Cup that's coming up in a few months, to try to get some kind of, the international community will boycott it, meaning the Western countries, okay, NATO and America. American allies. Do you think that's part of this here? That's one of the reasons why it's being pushed so hard without evidence, without the due process of law? Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, obviously, it's part of the game. I don't think it's the main part of the game. Obviously, there was an election in Russia before and so on. But what I find absolutely ridiculous is that they are saying that Russia actually had a motive. And they use this word over and over again.
What is the motive?
Well, they are saying the motive is allegedly to strengthen the support or Putin's support in Russia. And I was responding to them and saying, do you actually believe that the Russian people are so bloodthirsty that they would unite behind the leadership if they see somebody getting poisoned? Of all places in Britain. And this sounds so bizarre, and it's being repeated by journalists and by politicians and by other people. Now, I think personally, what the biggest lesson we have from what is going on now in Britain is that the media here, the press, is out of control. There needs to be a reform of the media here. Because what is happening, we have a tiny group of people controlling the whole of the British media, and nobody can do anything about it. And basically, from day one, the media already created the agenda.
Yep.
And in a sense, I even felt that the media boxed in some of the politicians.
Exactly.
And the politicians were afraid to say anything that would contradict the narrative. It's Russia, it's our enemy, Russia wants to destroy us.
Okay, well, it just proves to my guests here that lies and propaganda actually do sell well. All right, that's it. Many thanks to my guests in London and in Plymouth, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.